Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa. I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical research. Today's interview is with Alexis McLeod, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Asian Studies at the University of Connecticut. His new book, Philosophy of the Ancient Maya, Lords of Time, is just out from Lexington Books. The ancient Maya are popularly known for their calendar, but their concept of time and the metaphysics surrounding that conception are not. In his new book, McLeod reconstructs an ancient Mayan metaphysical system based on key texts and other artifacts, plus using analogies with ancient Chinese philosophical thought. On his view, the Maya held that we can understand everything in temporal terms, but that everything does not reduce to time, and that humans have a role in constructing manifest time and organizing the manifest world. McLeod also considers Mayan views of essences, truth, personal identity, and meaning. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Alexis McLeod.
Hi.
Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here to talk about your new book, Philosophy of the Ancient Maya, which is, it's kind of a whole new area of philosophy that, you know, I really don't know a whole lot about, and I don't think a lot of people do, because, as one colleague of mine said, did the Maya have a philosophy? What you do here is kind of put something on the table, do what I think of as a reconstruction, because the sources aren't, you know, as, you know, they're not abundant, and it's all, you know, fairly, ancient, writings and, stone tablets and things like that. Before we get into, how you reconstruct the philosophy or the possible philosophy of the Maya. Could you say a bit about yourself? How did you get to philosophy, to being a historian, basically of philosophy, and then to writing this particular book?
So I came to philosophy in somewhat strange way. I actually came through Chinese. So I studied Chinese language when I was an undergraduate. I took a medieval philosophy course and was kind of interested in philosophy as well, but discovered Chinese philosophy in Confucianism and Taoism and the early Chinese texts through some classes that were connected to my study in Chinese, and really just kind of fell in love with those texts. So I transferred into philosophy and started back where I was an undergraduate at University of Maryland. That was in the philosophy department. It was mainly Western contemporary analytic stuff, a few history classes as well. But I kind of discovered that there was this alternative way of encountering philosophy through Chinese philosophy. And that kind of got me into that, going in that direction. And so that's what I ended up focusing on was classical Chinese philosophy. And I get bored easily with projects, so I kind of wander a lot. In history in general, I tend to like kind of the the things that aren't covered as much, right, in the ancient world and historical philosophical texts. And kind of I discovered Maya thought actually working on astronomy. So I've had an interest in astronomy for years. I actually started in school in physics with the idea that I was going to study astronomy. And I was working on a book on ancient astronomy, which came out actually a couple years ago now, and discovered the early Maya. And because there's a lot of discussion of astronomy in the Maya texts that are available now, such as that we have today, such as the Dresden Codex. And as I was looking at Maya astronomy, I kept thinking it would be really cool if there was philosophical thought in early in the Maya tradition as well. But I kind of despaired that, well, we don't have the text, right? They're gone, and there is no philosophical tradition. And the more I learned, I started reading about the Maya and work that anthropologists have done on the Maya. And the more I learned about it, I learned there is a philosophical tradition in Maya thought, not only in the texts that are available, such as the four codices, the post-classic codices from before Spanish contact, but also in post-contact texts that that recount kind of earlier stories, and also in oral traditions, and also on stele and through kind of constructions like buildings and things like this, and other aspects of the culture. There's a rich philosophical tradition that we can see operative there, and anthropologists have actually discussed some of this, right? And some of the work they've written have gotten into the issue of Maya philosophy. And so I thought that, you know, this is something that philosophers aren't working on, in part because we don't know it's there. And so that kind of really sent me down the path of trying to learn as much as I could about the Maya and then develop and eventually became this book.
Great. You know, on the assumption that most listeners are sort of in my position at the very least, can you provide us a little bit of, you know, background about, you know, who are the people that we're talking about, at what, you know, timeline, you know, when are we talking about their civilization? You know, you note there's lots of really great drawings and other illustrations in the book of their glyphs, you know, their written language. And then, so tell us a little bit about them and the evidence, you know, the texts, the stele, all that stuff, that you're using as the touchstones for developing your metaphysics of them.
Sure. So the people that I'm discussing in the book, the Maya people, are still there today. There's this kind of older view that the Maya somehow disappeared, or there was a collapse of Maya civilization. It's been continuous until today. And the region that's the Maya region is roughly in the southern part, the southeast part of Mexico, all of Guatemala, Belize, and then the western parts of El Salvador and Honduras. There were a number of different cities in this region that during what's called the classic period of Maya culture, from around the 3rd century to the 10th century CE, a lot of these familiar features of classical Maya culture, such as the focus on calendrics, the construction of these elaborate cities, and the kind of the idea of the ruler, the various kinds of famous, well-known cities like Tikal, that is in contemporary Guatemala. These became central, right, in this period, right? So most of what I talk about in the book, much of it originated in the classic period and in the pre-classic. And there's also in the post-classic period, right, a kind of continuation and development of these ideas, and even in the post-contact period after the Spanish came in the 16th century, you still get kind of a renewal of Maya thought and different ways of thinking about these classical ideas, which resulted in what we see today, certain kinds of philosophical and religious syncretism, right, that involve kind of additions of aspects of Christianity to Maya thought, in which you get these really kind of interesting hybrids. So the The languages, as I was talking about the Maya people, the languages of these texts, the texts that we have, there are four codical texts that remain. There were many more likely written, these bark paper texts, but most of them were lost for a couple of reasons. So during the early part of the Spanish contact, the Spanish destroyed the text, thinking of them as kind of anti-Christian in some way. But I think the importance of that, although many texts were lost in this way, the importance is probably overstated, right? This idea that Diego de Landa, for example, is the infamous figure associated with this burning of books. It's one big problem in the Maya region is that these bark paper books are in what's mainly rainforest region, and so they don't store well, as texts do in, say, in the Middle East, right, in which it's dry, right, and texts can remain for many years. So that's another problem. Luckily, we do have a number of texts that are on stelae, on constructions, on buildings, on stelae that were erected by rulers to commemorate certain victories or certain accessions to rule, things like this. And then on things like pottery and other constructions, we have lots of glyphs and texts that are mainly the stelae texts are mainly concerned with dates of battles and of accessions, things like this. In addition to that, we have, as I mentioned before, we have the post-contact texts, and these are texts like the famous Quiche Maya Popol Vuh, or the books of Chilambalam, which recount stories, rituals, kind of philosophical positions that you find earlier in the Maya tradition. So the texts like the Popol Vuh, it certainly involve elements of things like Christianity, but they also involve these kind of earlier layers of Maya thought. And one of the ways that we can demonstrate that is that a lot of the stories that we see at the Popol Vuh have these kind of, they're represented in earlier artwork, right? So we see images of, say, the hero twins from the Popol Vuh in classic period artwork and various kind of stories that we find in the text. So one of the nice things actually about working in this area right now is that it's relatively recently that a vast kind of majority of the glyphs have been deciphered. It used to be the case not too long ago that much of these texts that we have couldn't be read, and so that was part of the issue, that it wasn't just kind of a lack of text, but also we didn't know how to read them. And so epigraphers and others who kind of interpret this stuff have now begun to really understand what's going on and how to read these texts. And in addition, archaeologists continually find more material in the Maya region. There was actually recently this, I don't know if you saw this it's National Geographic had this, about this LIDAR, I think they called it, a kind of radar that they showed that, a kind of technique, and they showed that the Maya cities in Mesoamerica were actually much more vast than we previously believed, which shows us a number of possible sites that haven't even been touched yet by archaeologists. So it's definitely an exciting time to be working on this area, because a lot is really starting to be understood now. Right?
Yeah, no, I did. One of the questions sort of was the extent to which we might expect that the various sorts of textual evidence is really just the tip of the iceberg, how much more we can expect to find at this point. And I think your answer seems to be, we don't really know. We could actually find quite a bit more than what we've got now.
Absolutely. And this is one of the things I keep, like, every day I keep up with. Maybe they'll uncover some interesting Maya text, right? But it's constantly happening, right? You'll see some information about an archaeologist who uncovers some new stelae, right? And people are reading it, and it's very exciting to find these. It happens in Chinese philosophy as well, but not quite as much as it seems to happen in the Maya world.
So, one of the, before you kind of get into the details of the various aspects of the Mayan philosophy, and primarily metaphysical issues, you talk about what you call your analogical method, right, for reconstructing. So, given the fact that there's just at this point, there's more than we thought, but there's still not a lot available for interpreting, right, the way we might interpret some other historical figure like Descartes or something. So a lot of this involves a bit of extrapolating, and you rely on your background in ancient Chinese philosophical work to do that reconstruction. So one of the, you know, you raise and address a number of problems for this method as well. I mean, you know, the obvious sort of question of, well, you know, maybe you've put together something that makes sense, but how do we know that that's what they, you know, that was their, you know, metaphysics, or just the dependence on the fact that, you know, your expertise is in Chinese philosophy, and so that's a natural place for you to begin, you know, kind of for your reconstruction. You know, somebody else might have a different way of putting it together. So could you say a bit about, you know, the analogical method, and then how you address, you know, the concerns that might be raised about that?
Yeah, so the analogical method, I mean, I see it as a kind of additional tool in the toolkit that historians of philosophy can use to try to construct plausible interpretations of these systems that can be used not only in the case of Maya thought, but in case of, you know, Chinese thought or kind of early modern European thought, and any different kind of area of the history of philosophy. And I think it really is something that you see often in the history of philosophy, maybe more than we recognize. It seems to me that we already kind of implicitly use it in a lot of ways when we do things like call one thing that you used to commonly see, or you see sometimes still, is a discussion of early Confucianism as, say, virtue ethics, right? Or when we use kind of terms or concepts that are part of our kind of contemporary philosophical tradition to understand things that are going on in early China or in Maya thought or any other place. And it seems like to me what we're doing there is we're reading these texts, we're looking at these traditions using a particular frame. And so the analogical method is a kind of way of doing something like this, right? It goes a bit beyond this in that there's a kind of assumption behind it, which I get into to some extent in the book, that human minds tend to work generally in the same way. And so when we see these systems develop, what I notice at least is that these systems seem to develop in somewhat similar ways across traditions. They're not always exactly the same, of course, but the way that that you kind of construct a correlative metaphysics, for example, in early China, tends to look a lot like the ways that we see these develop in other areas as well. And so, if we can use this kind of interpretive frame of early China or of certain aspects of Western thought to make sense of things that aren't quite clear in Maya thought because there aren't enough texts, or just because we've lost so much, that it doesn't show that this is necessarily what the Maya held, but I think it gives us a kind of plausible interpretation. That's one possibility, which I think ends up being really no more than we can do with most of our historical interpretations. Because when we have to give interpretations, the idea is that there's something that hasn't been said, right? Or there's something that's left unclear. And so our interpretations often are constructed on the basis of, say, something like the principle of charity, in which we just try to make the most sense of, say, Plato's view, right? To make it the most plausible we can, right? Which is another kind of method that doesn't show that this is necessarily what Plato or anyone else held, but it shows that here's what a consistent view might look like, something like this. And so that's what I take it that I'm kind of doing with the analogical method, is offering just another tool that we can use to build consistent interpretations, and also one that might help us to kind of understand how these various ideas emerge in similar ways within different traditions. So it kind of plays this role of helping the comparative philosophical project as well.
And that's an issue you get to actually at the very end of the book. But we can get to that in a bit. So let's get to the the defense and articulation of the metaphysics. So the subtitle of the book is, you know, Lords of Time, and you know, if anybody knows anything about the Maya who isn't a Mayanist or something like that, it's the idea of this, you know, Mayan calendar and the whole idea of calendars. And in fact, that what you point out, erroneous idea that, you know, you had this calendar that said the end of days and there was going to be like literally the end of the world, and they didn't quite happen. But in any case, I mean, time is clearly a central concept in their philosophy. And so there's a lot of different aspects to that you talk about in the book, which You know, there's not just one question there about time, but let me just start, you know, just to start us off. What is time, you know, as they're conceiving of it? And then I'll ask about the calendrics, you know, after that. But let's just start with, you know, the basic question, you know, what is time for them?
Yeah, so time, it plays a lot of different roles in early Maya thought. One of the kind of central roles that it plays is to help them understand how to make sense of change, and also how to make sense of the human role in constructing or in completing the cosmos, which is actually something that I notice is kind of similar to some of the things that you see in the early Chinese tradition. So the title, the Lords of Time title, actually comes from the idea of the ruler in early Maya thought, the Ahau, and the role that the ruler has in structuring and keeping the sacred time. And you see a kind of identification of rulers with time. So time, in one sense, and this is part of the reason that some read it as this kind of fundamental constituent of the world, time is a way to make sense of what exists in the world, right? So the idea is that, so I don't understand it as a kind of, as something that everything reduces to in the way some do, but the idea is that everything can be understood in terms of its kind of description as far as it is something like time. So in many of the early texts and in the Popol Vuh, for example, we see this kind of, this position that humans have a role in constructing and manifesting time. So you have, at the beginning, right, there's a story in the Popol Vuh where the gods are creating the world and they create humanity. And one of the things that, so there, it's a very famous story that they try to create humanity, these kind of wooden beings, and they aren't successful and they have to redo it over and over again. And the idea is that what caused them to fail in this creation of humanity is that each of these earlier versions of what they were trying to attain couldn't do what they called keeping the days, right? These things, these wooden creatures they made couldn't keep the days, and thus they were unsuccessful as humans. And then finally, when they get to create humans, they're successful in keeping the days. But part of the idea being that humans play this role in somehow completing what the gods have done, right? The gods have supplied this kind of basic substrate of nature, and that humans construct this into things in certain ways. And time is one of the central things that they construct, right? Out of this kind of basic what we might call ground of being, something like this. This is part of the reason that you see the role, even today, of the daykeeper, right, in the Yucatan, for example, in other areas in the Maya region, as being central, right? The daykeeper having this kind of central ritual role, with the idea that keeping the days, right, and having the kind of the fixing the sacred calendar is not only an act of a kind of ritual religious act, but it's also an act that helps construct the world in a certain way, right? That contributes to what I call in the book continual creation. And so time, I think, for the early Maya really represents the human role in organizing the world in a certain way. Now, that said, humans don't just kind of create time out of nothing, right? It's not completely arbitrary or completely conventional, but rather they do what we might call manifest time, right? So there are these kind of unconceptualized patterns that form what we might call the ground of being, and that time and also other entities are constructed out of this. I talk in the book about how what I call this basic ground of being for the Maya is very similar to this conception of Tao in the early Chinese tradition, in which it's, especially in the Taoist tradition, in which it's something that itself is ineffable, in itself, but can be accessed by humans in certain ways, and can be conceptualized such that things come about from this conceptualization of the Tao. And in the in early Maya thought, this involves this concept that they call ordering or tzak, with the idea that when we order the world in a certain way, or even when we measure the world in a certain way, that this creates new things. This act of ordering is itself what completes the cosmos.
So what's the relationship then between the constructed time that humans have an essential role in doing, and then the ineffable time or I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but that is out there sort of independently. I don't know. I don't even know if that's the right way to put it, but is there another, you know, reality? Maybe I'll put it that way. And then there's this more manifest thing that we do. And is there any relation between them, or is just the other, this other ineffable thing just like, doesn't even matter really whether it's there or not?
I think there's certainly a relationship between them. In fact, we wouldn't be able to do what we do, right? We wouldn't be able to construct these things through conceptualization if there wasn't this ground of being. Right? In a sense, it reminds me in some ways of this kind of Kantian conception between the noumenal and the phenomenal, right? Something that's there and that needs to be there, but we don't directly access as such, right? There's a similar idea here, right? That what we access are these kind of conceptualized things, right, that we've, in a sense, kind of conventionally constructed. But all of these are dependent on and in a sense, built out of this kind of basic stuff, right, which can't in itself be characterized using any of the concepts that we impose onto it, right, in a sense, impose onto it, right? So we follow part of the difficulty is that we follow these kind of patterns that are manifest in the ground of nature. But those patterns are things, and this is similar to what we see in the Taoist tradition, those patterns are things that ultimately can't be accurately characterized using concepts, using language, etc. For the Taoist tradition, one kind of important difference, for the Taoist tradition, it's we can understand and grasp these patterns by responding to them through activity, right? So when we act in certain ways, right, this shows our kind of understanding of the patterns. Whereas here, for the Maya, right, there doesn't seem to be that conception, at least from what we have in the text, right? This notion that behaving in certain ways, right, kind of represents these patterns. But there does seem to be a similarity in that somehow we can understand and access them. And then once we do that, we can manifest them in language. One way to understand this, one way that I sometimes use when I teach this, is to understand, to think about things like natural laws or physical laws, something like this. So when we're kind of Einstein coming up with the theories of special and general relativity, right, that we're accessing something in the world that isn't kind of manifest, right, right away, right? We don't see this when we look out at the world and we look at trees and houses and persons and things like this. But nonetheless, when Einstein constructs this theory, he's manifesting something. He's giving us something that is itself inherent in the world and allowing us through that construction of a theory to now access this kind of this natural law in a different way that we couldn't necessarily do before. It's something like this is going on in early Maya thought as well.
Okay, so how does this construction, you know, happen? I think, you know, a lot of the discussion of, you know, what you mentioned, the daykeepers, and there's this other discussion of the seating of rulers and the development of different calendars, right? You know, so a calendar is a manifest or representation in some way of this constructed time. And you can have different calendars, right? So, you know, we just have one. I mean, so that's an interesting difference. So can you say something about, you know, how we go about, or humans or Mayan leaders or specific Mayans who play specific social roles, how the calendars and time are constructed?
Yeah, so the idea is that there are multiple, given the kind of patterns that are there in the ground of nature, there are multiple ways that we might that we might conceptualize this, or that we might kind of put bounds on certain time periods, things like this. If we think about calendars, this is actually a kind of good example. And so we actually do something much more like the Maya than we may think. For example, if you look at the kind of Gregorian calendar that we use, right, to mark days, we also have academic calendars, for example, right? Those of us in academics tend to think more in terms of those, right, than the Gregorian. And they serve different purposes, and they're different ways that we can kind of that we can define time periods and their importance to us. With the Maya calendars, you have something very similar going on. Right? The idea is that you have, say, something like the Dzogchen ritual calendar, and then you've got a kind of year calendar, and these are playing these kind of different roles, right? So we can organize time, or we can construct time with particular ends in mind, right? A ritual end, or having an agricultural end, things like this, and the goals that we have are going to generally kind of guide the ways that we construct these calendars in different ways, just like in the case of, say, the Gregorian versus the academic calendar.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. But all of those different calendars that we have, you know, the academic calendar, they're all, you know, there's a fundamental, you might say, you know, temporal calendar, which is based on the physics of, you know, the Earth spinning around on its axis and around the sun. And so there's kind of a fundamental temporal calendar, if you want to, I don't know if you want to even call it a calendar, but there's this, you know, time, at least, I mean, there's a whole metaphysics of time, but let's just forget that for the moment. Just say, yeah, you know, there's this time that is occurring, you know, in the physical universe. And then we build our calendars in relation to that. You have a lunar calendar and you have the academic calendar, all that stuff. But that temporal, you know, that time is not something that we construct. So I'm just, at least that's the, you know, that's the way you might think of it. And so do they only have these calendars, or is there another conception below it which says, oh, and all these calendars are built out of this time, which really isn't, you know, sort of up to us?
Yeah. So all of these are built out of this kind of what I call this basic ground of being, right? Which isn't itself something that we might think of as temporal. And it's not, I think it's not all too different than what we have. For example, you mentioned this kind of conception of time, right? As something that exists independently of these measurements. But the way that it seems to me that we actually don't have such a kind of defined conception of time. If we think about something like the atomic clock, for example, right? We're always defining time in terms of the particular events, right? So we look at particular times. I think that works this way, right? For certain kinds of decay to happen that are generally regular or something like this, right? And we have this kind of assumption or this idea that there's something regular behind this, right? But we never seem to access, we never access that regular thing through the measurement itself. It's all kind of looking at particular events and their regularity and how they're related to other events, things like this, which is how we generally define time. And it seems like they're doing something similar, but without the assumption that there is some independent kind of basic time behind any of these kind of these comparisons between various different events and how they take place. But they think there's something there, but it's this kind of ground of being, right, that I was talking about before that can be conceptualized in certain ways.
So let me just continue along that trend. Is this when you say the basic ground of being, is that the concept of it's that you mention, that you talk about in the book, or is that a separate one?
Yeah, so it's is related to this, right? So the way that I read all of these various kind of central concepts like time and it's and chul and others, things like this, are that they're all dependent on this ground of being, right? But the ground of being itself is something much like the kind of the noumenal or the Tao or something like this, which can't be characterized ultimately in terms of things like it's or chul or any of the other things that we want to talk about, but that's the basis of all of those. And so in some sense, right, it seems like it's transcended, right? Even though I kind of make this argument that there's a single world, we can understand transcendence as the kind of the hiddenness, right, of aspects of this world.
So you've mentioned already, you know, that, you know, some people, although not you, you know, think of the Mayan metaphysics as somehow where everything reduces to time. And you argue against that. You say, you know, no, it's more of what you call a correlationist metaphysics. Can you explain that and the difference between your interpretation and, I don't know if it's a standard one, but it's one that's, you know, it's out there, right?
Yeah. So there are a few. Famously, Miguel León Portilla made this argument that that time is this kind of basic element in Maya thought, and that other things like the gods or individuals, everything that exists, ultimately reduces to time. And so my view here is that it seems like in a number of the texts we have there's evidence that elements, everything can be understood as an element of time, right? So the gods or the rulers or each individual can be understood ultimately as, or can be understood as time. But time ultimately can also be understood as those things. It seems that neither level is the fundamental level, right? So they're both an alternative way of understanding this, which I use this kind of Taoist frame to develop, is to say, well, maybe what's going on is that numbers and time and the gods and all these various things that are understood in terms of one another in the Maya text are all themselves ways of understanding this kind of ineffable ground of being, right? Rather than reducible to any one of those things. Right? So that if we understand the gods or particular ruler as identified with a particular time period, it's not that what the god most fundamentally is a time period, but rather it's one way of describing that entity is in terms of the time period, and another way of describing that entity is in terms of this particular ruler. Right? Those are both ways of conceptualizing this ground of being.
Okay, so what's the correlational part?
Oh, the correlative cosmology bit. Yeah. So the idea here is that there are particular correlations between different aspects of the world, right, as we conceptualize them. And this is what makes it possible for there to be transformations between things like a particular ruler in a particular time period and a particular number, things like this, right? And so the idea is that what makes sense of why all of those things can be the same isn't a kind of reduction from one to another, but a particular correlative pattern, right? that connects one type of thing to another type of thing. Right? That's the idea, and which is something that I find that you find in Han Dynasty Chinese thought in particular, right? With this notion of the five phases, right? With the five phases being similar to the kind of elements theory in ancient Greece, in which when you've got a phase that's represented in a particular object, it's got this connection and can produce other objects of similar type.
Okay, I see. That was helpful. So there's this concept of what you call embedded identity, which comes up at various points in the book. Could you explain that?
Yeah. So embedded identity it's an important part of this kind of correlative picture that I was talking about before. And one of the concepts that's important here is this concept of seeding or chum. There are a number of images. I have a couple of these in the book, for example, that talk about the seeding of rulers or the seeding of time, things like this. And the way that this is understood, I argue, is in terms of embedding new identities into particular persons, particular things, that is adding potential, adding new layers to an individual thing such that new entities are manifest within it. So the idea is that you can have a particular individual, say myself, Alexis MacLeod, and I can be Alexis MacLeod, but at the same time, when the embedded identity is operative, I can also be, say, my grandfather, and just be and actually be identical to my grandfather. And this happens not only in the case of persons, but also in the case of objects. And the concept that's often discussed here is the concept of substitution or kish. The idea is that during certain performances, right, performances of the Popol Vuh or performances where particular dancers or actors play the role of one of the gods, they can actually become the people who are depicted rather than depicting them. With the idea being that the reason they can become this other individual is because they always include this kind of potential to be those things, given a different kind of conceptualization of the ground of being. One way of understanding this, I talk about this concept of kin or the day in Maya thought, and the glyph for the day actually isn't the, as it is in Chinese, the term for day is an image of, initially an image of the sun. In the classic Maya glyphs, it's an image of a flower, with the idea seeming to be that the sun is in a sense contained in the flower because it's the it's a particular cause of the flower. There's this view in early and classical Indian philosophy called Satkaryavada, which holds that the cause of the, any cause is included in the effect, right? And so if I'm looking at the flower, right, the sun, the soil, all the things that cause this flower are included in it. And it ends up becoming this view that everything is included in everything else. And so if that's the case, right, for the Maya, then that flower is potentially a flower, and it's also potentially the sun, and it's also potentially anything else it could cause as well. So one way of looking at embedded identity is in terms of, if we look at this in terms of the person, part of what causes me is all my ancestors, right, and the gods and things like this. And so insofar as I perform those activities that my grandparents performed or that the gods performed, I actually become identical with them as such, right, in this performance. And so this is why you see, for example, on stele, the manifestations of or images of particular rulers on the stele in Copan, for example, the ruler Washaklajun Ubakwil, this was seen as not just a kind of representation of the ruler, but as being identical with the ruler. And so you'd see in instances of warfare, people would destroy certain stele and constructions with the idea that they were destroying the ruler himself, right, by doing this, right, because these objects were part of the ruler as such.
So that sort of makes, so there's one thing I think I need clarification. So a cause, you know, at least as we conceive of this relationship, is, you know, a cause is necessarily distinct from its effect. So how do they reconcile this idea that, you know, the effect, you know, in the one sense contains the cause, and then the other idea that the effect, you know, can be identified with the cause?
Yeah. So what the idea is that we can see this if we see what's fundamentally going on as a particular kind of process, right? So if we think of something like the case of the growth of a new plant or reproduction in the case of a person, something like this, we can see a kind of biological process going on. And the idea is that where we decide to kind of make the boundaries between one entity and another, they're going to say is in some sense kind of arbitrary, right? We can see that, well, there's just a single biological process going on here. And so the idea is that what we call cause and effect is going to be based on in part on how we define what the objects are, right, that are the causing the effect. So the idea being that one way we can understand this is a single kind of process, and where we draw the lines is going to be a matter of our concerns in part, right, which is actually part of what leads to this view of embedded identity as well, right? So whether I count as my grandfather or not in part depends on the concerns of the community, right? What role I'm playing in the community, whether I'm playing his role in the community, something like this.
So are these boundaries like totally fungible, or are there constraints on them?
Yeah. This is a good question. So it seems like there are constraints on, especially when we think about this in terms of things like the ruler or the ways that I might substitute something like this. And so it's not clear that I can substitute someone else's grandparents, something like this, right? But it does seem like anything that's in my kind of lineage, I can substitute, including things like the gods, right? Because the humans in general, right, are kind of in this lineage of the gods. And so when there's kind of production of the Popol Vuh, right, many of us can perform this role. This is part of the reason that that there's so much focus on the ruler in the classic period, with the idea being that the ruler has this kind of, is part of this process, or that is connected to these various important figures who had this kind of ability to reveal aspects of the world that the rest of us don't have. So there are kind of there are boundaries on how broadly we can apply this, right? On what we potentially can be, right? So we have the potential to be identified with a given number of things, but not just anything, right? And this is a matter of how the patterns of the world are structured, right? For example, in which really kind of gets to the issue too about what's objective about the way that we say construct time. So even for things like calendars, they don't want to say something like, we could just do anything, right? We could just kind of create it in any way we want it. Right? We have to follow these inherent patterns of nature. The inherent patterns of nature themselves ultimately are ineffable, are things that we don't grasp in the usual ways. But it's tricky, right? Because as soon as we say something like that, well, then we have to ask the question, well, how are we able to do it, right? How do we know that we've got it right and we've got it wrong, right, given different particular concepts, right? And that's a real problem in this tradition, I think, as well as in the Taoist tradition.
Okay, yeah. So let me just, right and wrong, you know, let's talk about truth. I mean, that's one of the things. And one of the interesting things that you mention or that you suggest, I don't know if this is a fully fledged semantics for the Mayan glyphs, but you do mention at one point or more than one point the idea of a theory of meaning as one of substitution. I mean, you've brought up the concept of substitution before, but here in terms of the idea of the glyphs and what we would say refer to certain things in the world, you suggest that there is really no reference relationship. So could you explain the meaning of glyphs, you know, in this alternative substitutional view in some way? I don't want to say substitutional because that has particular, a particular meaning in like formal logic, right? But could you explain this way you understand the meaning of the glyph?
So it is a substitutional view in the sense that of Kesh, right? Kesh has substitution in the way that I described it with embedded identity, right? That's kind of what's going on, I argue, right? That idea being that the glyphs aren't kind of signs, right? That kind of refer to particular objects, things like this, right? But that through this issue of embedded identity, they become the objects themselves, right? So the idea is that the glyphs themselves can be seen as substitutes, as kish in this way, such that you can refer to, when you write the glyph for the god, for example, the god, and this is in term of kind of its, is contained in that glyph, right? So that is the god, right? Or that is the ruler, something like this, right? So the idea is that a glyph for any given thing, the glyph for a city, the emblem glyph for a city, or the glyph for an individual, becomes that city or that individual. And the way that it does this is that it contains its, right? The essence of the ruler or the city or whatever we're talking about is contained in this glyph through the construction of this glyph. It's seated in that sense, right? And it's kind of embedded in the same way. So when we encounter the glyphs, right, when we're reading the glyphs, right, we're actually encountering these objects. And this in part is, I think, the reason that so much kind of care went into the construction of the glyphs, and why part of the reason that the scribes and kind of artists in Maya culture were kind of held in such high regard, because it wasn't just that they were recording kind of events, but they were able to capture the essence of these objects such that they could create them, right, through the construction of these glyphs, whether it's on bark paper or whether it's on stelae, something like this.
Which raises interesting questions about, you know, between types and tokens. Are there,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Is there any indication of, were they aware of that distinction or?
Yes, yeah, so I think that, so in, when you talk about the language, I think every kind of instance of a glyph is just that object. So part of what they want to say is that you can have this kind of represented multiply, something like this, right? And so the king, for example, Washaklo Junubakuil, can exist as the person who's talking to you, and he can also exist in the form of this glyph and another glyph at the same time, right? It just becomes another kind of iteration, if you will, of that individual, right? I think that's the way that they're looking at it, right? They don't want to say something like that, because generally what we're going to take to be the case is that if there's some individual Washaklo Junubakuil that exists at one time, there can't be something else distinct at that same time who's also identical to him. And they want to say that, no, there could be many things, right? In a sense, Washaklo Junubakuil is extended in this way, right, through these multiple different objects. And every time you get an additional glyph, that's another extension of the essence of Washaklo Junubakuil.
So it sounds like they conceive of the gods as universals. Would that be correct?
Yeah, that's one way of looking at how they think about the gods, and not just the gods, I think, but all these other kinds of fundamental aspects. Well, I don't want to call them fundamental. These other kind of aspects of ways that we can characterize the ground of being as well, such as number, time, all of these kinds of things, right? Could be seen in much the same way.
Okay. Well, that sort of raises the issue for you also talk about their views of personhood and you know, personal identity. And there's a couple of connected concepts there where you had the idea, the general idea of its or, you know, essence. And then there's a human form of that, which is, I think, Chul or something. And then there's a aspect of the human essence, which is a social aspect or communal aspect. Could you explain their view of human personal identity?
Yeah. So things like it. This can be understood as essence in general, right? That's not individuating, right? But it's something that that all humans share. Right? In that way, seemingly like this notion of vital essence, right? That you find in the early Chinese tradition in terms of qi. There's this other concept, Chul, which is identified specifically with humans, and it's usually associated with blood. And part of the reason for this is that in the royal bloodletting ceremonies, the idea was that the blood, especially of royals, had a particular kind of power and potency that would reveal other aspects of the world, right? Because of its richness, right? In terms of this Chul, and so it can be more concentrated or potent in one person than another person. But it's not something that's kind of that represents individual features of us. So there's this other concept of why, something like a kind of communal or social essence in that way, which we might see as linked with something like social identity, right? Or individuating features of persons, things like this. And so when we think about things like roles or position or character traits, right, we can associate this with, this is generally what determines a particular individual's why, while we at the same time have this essence that we ultimately share with other humans as well. And one of the interesting things about this concept of essence is one of the ways it seems to be understood is as that which makes things what they are. Right? This is the idea, and this kind of leads in the tradition, I suspect, to something similar to what it leads to in early Chinese tradition, which is a particular conception of truth. So the idea is that what makes an entity that entity is its. And the person who's able to manipulate its, or the itsam, right, the sage, right, the shaman in this sense, right, understands and can grasp what makes each thing as it is, right, or the essence of the thing, right, which becomes to be understood as truth in the sense of a thing kind of meeting some or matching some particular ideal. And so part of what's going on here is that they're understanding truth, I think, in this kind of broader sense, in the way that we see it in the Chinese tradition and in certain kind of outside of philosophy, even in English as well, when we say things like the true person or a true friend, something like that, right? The idea being that this is something that possesses the essence of a person or a friend, something like this. And then they extend this in the same way we see in the Chinese tradition to a consideration of language, right? So just like you might have the essence of the friend or the person, you can have the same thing for a statement. We can understand linguistic truth in that sense as the essence of the statement specifically, right? Which ties it to this kind of broader conception of truth as it applies to other objects.
So, I mean, this is more of a clarificatory question. Is in all these talk of essence, are these hexaedi type essences, individual essences, or are they just like my little bit of the global essence or universe? You know,
it's more of the latter, right? So something like a hexaedi, right, would point out this object as this object, right? It would be something that's its alone, something like this, right? So it isn't meant to be something like that, right? It's something that's much more kind of general, right? In the kind of second option that you mentioned, right? The idea that it might be concentrated in a certain place, right? But it's not something that marks me out as individually me, right? In the way that something like a hexaedi would. Something like why is something that would do this, right? Or in kind of figuring out location within community, things like this. But it's much more general. And it's can be, it's available. So it is also something that other things other than humans have and can be manipulated, and kind of, used in order to see these hidden aspects of the world by people who really, who kind of understand the essence of things, which are the these itzam or sages.
Okay. I guess that makes sense that it would not be a Hayek-Sadie type concept because of what you had said before about embedded identity. It would be very difficult to have that view of embedded identity if you also had a view of, you know, I mean, it would just be like the whole thing just wouldn't fit together.
Right, right. You have to say a thing has multiple dissonances, something like this.
Right. It just wouldn't be coherent. Yeah. Which doesn't mean they couldn't hold it. But anyway, so let me just let me ask about you have a there's a couple of future projects or you know indications of where to go from here at the end of the book. So for example, the relation between Mayan thought and Aztec thought. Could you say something about that particular direction? I mean, are there close? I mean, most of your reconstruction has been in relation to Chinese thought, right? Not Aztec thought. And, you know, one might ask, well, you know, why wouldn't you do it with Aztec thought, since it seems to be roughly, you know, at least closer in, you know, geographical distance? So what's the relation between the Mayan thought and the Aztec thought?
So there's a very close relationship. In fact, there's influence, right, in kind of both directions. In fact, some of the work that I'm doing right now focuses on just that. So one of the only other people in philosophy I know who's working on this area, Jim Maffey, who works on Aztec philosophy, I've kind of been in discussions with this about. And the kind of difficulties there, I mean, it's close, right? But in a way that makes it a little bit more tricky as well, right? Because you're always trying to kind of pull out, okay, what here is Maya? What here is Aztec? What here is something different? Something like this. And so it makes it a little bit harder, just in the same way as looking at some of these, the post-contact texts, right? And trying to kind of compare this to classic period texts and figure out which one is classic and which one is post-contact. I think it's certainly a useful project and one that I'm definitely committed to looking more into. But in this project, I was mainly concerned with trying to figure out, okay, what's going on here concerning classic period Maya thought, right? And so I didn't want to get too involved into Aztec thought and kind of reading too much of that into it. But I think the kind of one of the interesting things that we can do with this is definitely, of course, read it in the using as a frame other forms of Mesoamerican thought. Right, that's maybe the kind of the natural way of pursuing this project, and certainly something that I'm working on now. Including another way, right, would be to read this in terms of Western thought, right, as a frame, which is a kind of common way that you see a lot of non-Western texts read. Part of the reason that I read this text in this way is to using classical Chinese thought is to suggest a kind of alternative way of approaching these texts, including which includes right the kind of the benefit that we see particular problems like the problem of truth, right, knowledge, you know, essence, things like this in different ways when we use these different traditions as frames to encounter things like the Maya tradition, which will of course happen in the case of the Aztec tradition as well.
Okay. And I assume part of that might be the impact of the, you know, what you say, the contact, right? You know, the arrival of the Spaniards and what that did to both civilizations, I suppose. Yeah. So another topic that you also sort of raise is, you know, at the end is a plea sort of for you know, de-Westernizing of philosophy. And certainly, you know, we have both been trained in that tradition, the analytic philosophical tradition. You know, there has been, you know, I would say in recent years, you know, attempts to, you know, do more with Chinese philosophy, certainly with Indian philosophy, and now with Maya and African philosophy, and so forth. So, you know, two points here is, you know, how do you see that? You know, how do you see that as best kind of proceeding? And you know, especially given this, since given that a lot of people are reluctant to even include, say, a Chinese thinker on their syllabus because, you know, nobody's, you know, many people are just not familiar with it. So there's, you know, how this might proceed, but also there's the general, you know, problem, you might say, of just, you know, who gets to say what, which has come up in other, you know, in other philosophical controversies, you know, public controversies about, you know, racism or feminism or transgender identity and, you know, the things where, you know, certain, you know, when some outsider, you know, for, you know, just say a, you know, some Westerner talking, you know, as an expert on Chinese philosophy or, you know, this sort of where you're, where the person doing the analysis is not a member of the tradition itself and has no connection to it other than a, you know, basically an intellectual one. And that's a, you know, many people, you know, see that as a problem is, you know, who basically, you know, who are you to tell us, you know, what we think and so forth. So how do you see the de-Westernizing, you know, possibly proceeding and how do you respond to that worry of you know, groups who have, you know, been marginalized. I mean, clearly that's the case with these non-Western philosophies, you know, that, you know, who are you guys to, you know, kind of, you know, tell us what our tradition is like.
Right. So I think there are a couple of things going on with it. One of the interesting things I've been kind of thinking about recently is this second kind of idea that you talk about, you know, who gets to say these things and, you know, issues of cultural appropriation, things like that. My own view on this, right? So is that, so there are a couple of ways of responding to this idea that, that there's a certain kind of background that one needs to have in order to understand, in order to properly be able to put forward a particular kind of thought. I think that that really is a kind of, is a mistake, right? And so when we think about things like studying Descartes or Kant, something like this, right? Hardly anyone, right? I've never heard it said, at least, that one needs to be French, right, in order to understand Descartes, or one needs to be Prussian, right, in order to understand Kant, something like this, right? And so I think in part, because there's the idea that when one tries to understand the thought of Kant, right, one isn't trying to understand the thought of Prussian or German people, something like this, right? In a sense, I think the same thing should be the case in Chinese thought or early Maya thought, something like this. Now, there is some sense in which one can study, right, or one can try to understand the thought of Maya people or what they think right now or their attitude, something like this, which I think would be a kind of very different project, right? And maybe one in which the kind of the voice and authority of a Maya person would certainly be something that you have to take account of, right? But I think in understanding Maya philosophy or understanding Chinese philosophy, really it's no different than understanding Kant or Descartes or something like this. And I think part of the reason that sometimes we think it is, right, it's, I think we're well-meaning, but I think it really is a kind of relic of colonialism and the othering of non-Western people, right, and the idea that non-Western modes of thought are culture-bound in ways that Western thought isn't culture-bound. And so sometimes the response to this, when we recognize this, has been to say, well, Western thought is culture bound too, right? That, you know, Descartes and Kant and all these kind of things were just as contained in their culture as early Chinese and Maya philosophers. But I think that's kind of the wrong response. I think a better response would be to take the other kind of way out and say something like, well, maybe we should think of Chinese and Maya thought as just as universal as Western thought, right? Rather than isolating each of them. I kind of my general view about this and things like cultural appropriation is that those things in themselves aren't problematic. I think what the problem is, and there is a real problem that people are concerned about here, but I think the problem is not valuing certain people, right? So while we might say something like, I'm going to study Maya thought and I'm going to study Chinese thought and I think these things are great and I'm going to interpret them, but I'm still going to then turn around and just like restrict access to what I'm doing from Maya people or Chinese people or something like this, right? I think that's the problem, right? Are the ways that we think about the individual people, right? Which is independent from the ways that we think about Maya thought or Chinese thought, something like this. And so I think one way, and I actually think that kind of broadening our conception of what philosophy is and the ways that we engage in kind of history of philosophy can actually help with that as well, right? With the idea being that, you know, once we, if we can do something like, say, you know, something as easy as, you know, hire more people teaching non-Western traditions in philosophy departments such that, and require it to be studied, right, for our PhD students, things like that, such that when we construct conceptions of a history of philosophy, we expect it to be, to include things like Aztec, Maya, Chinese, Indian, et cetera, thought, right? I think that can go part way toward also being more accepting of different kinds of people, right? And diversity in this kind of different sense.
Well, we could continue talking, but we're out of time. So I like to end with a final question, which you may have already partly answered, at least, which is what's on the horizon for you? What are you working on now?
Yeah, so I'm all over the place. It's hard for me to stay on the same project or the same area kind of for more than one book or so. So I just finished a book on the Han Dynasty Chinese philosopher Wang Chong, and I'm working right now on a project on madness in early China and how this kind of connects to the ways that they thought about personhood and the value that some thinkers actually gave to this concept of quang or madness. So that's one project. And then I'm also working on another book with an old student of mine, Josh Brown at Mount St. Mary's University, on transcendence and substance in the early Chinese tradition. So those are kind of the things that the multiple ways I'm being scattered right now on these various different projects.
Very good. Okay. Well, I look forward to hearing more about all those projects. They sound very interesting. But we are out of time now, so I just want to thank you again for taking the time to talk with us at New Books in Philosophy about your new book.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it. And thank you for inviting me.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to my interview with Alexis McLeod, who is Associate Professor of Philosophy and also in the Asian and Asian American Studies Institute at the University of Connecticut. We've been talking about his new book, Philosophy of the Ancient Maya, Lords of Time, which is just out from Lexington Books. This is Carrie Figdor, speaking for New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.